I wish now to introduce this beautiful, well-known poem from Isaiah 52:13 to 53:12. It's about the suffering and rejected servant of Yahweh. We use it on Good Friday and apply it for really obvious reasons to Jesus. My question is, what's the background for the original poem and who might they have had in mind when they were writing? So who is the suffering and rejected servant described in this poem? Is it Israel? Isaiah ben Amoz spoke of Judah as the vineyard that yielded bitter grapes, as a woman in the pangs of childbirth, as clay shaped by a potter. He spoke of the people eating the bread of adversity and drinking the water of affliction. He spoke of the people as blind, deaf, lame, and dumb. But thanks to Yahweh's faithful love, says Isaiah ben Amoz, there'll always be hope. And now I quote from chapter 35, verse 5 to 6, that the eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped, the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the speechless sing for joy. Now the prophet preachers in exile have just likened Jerusalem to a bereaved and barren mother who's overcome at the sight of her children returning from exile. We saw that in chapter 49, verse 21. Are they now, in this poem, recalling the terrible experiences of abuse and rejection suffered by Israel, Yahweh's servant, and saying that the nation, the land, the city has suffered because of the sins of the people, but that the nation, Yahweh's suffering servant, would rise again? Or, a second possibility, is their focus somewhat narrower? In introducing this section, I suggested that those responsible for this material, the Isaiah school, came to the realization that Yahweh was calling them to realize the mission given to the people, the mission which the people had largely failed to take up. They saw themselves, the school, the authors of 40 to 48, as being called by Yahweh to be his servants. They said as much in chapter 49, verses 1 to 6. And later in chapter 54 to 9, they'll speak of their being rejected and abused. Are they speaking here in this poem of themselves as Yahweh's faithful servants who've been rejected because of the sins of their compatriots, but confident that they would be vindicated? So, is this poem focusing on the whole of exiled Judah, or despised and bruised and abused, and or are they actually talking about their group who've been rejected by the other exiles? We could also ask, is the depiction of the suffering, rejected but ultimately vindicated servant simply an extended metaphor, either for Israel or for the school of prophet preachers? Or are its authors also reflecting on and identifying with the experience of the historical Isaiah, Isaiah ben Amoz? Nearer to home, were they reflecting on the experience of a significant member of their own group? Is the suffering and rejected servant maybe the leader of this Isaiah school? So I've offered you four alternatives, really. Is it the nation in exile? Is it the group, the Isaiah school? Is it reflecting back on their original Isaiah ben Amoz? Or is it talking about the leader of their school? Now, there seems no persuasive argument that would require us to eliminate any of the above suggestions. The poem has its own dynamic power. Perhaps it would be best to let it do what poetry does best. Listen to it and let it carry us. Because of the obvious parallels with the suffering and death of Jesus, the New Testament writers frequently point to this passage to help persuade their fellow Jews to look more carefully at Jesus. Like the servant eulogized here in this poem, Jesus was abused and rejected. Also, like him, Jesus was the one who was faithful to the call and mission of God. Jesus' disciples were helped by this passage to get some insight into the mystery of Jesus' suffering and death, and how it was his response in faithful love that astonished his disciples and helped them find words to convey to others how Jesus, like the servant of this poem, through his faithful love, revealed for everyone to see the wonder of the faithful love of God. So, having introduced this beautiful poem, let's now present it. Isaiah chapter 52, verse 13 reads, "See, my servant shall prosper. Israel, maybe, the Isaian school, maybe. He shall be exalted, lifted up, he shall be very high. Just as there were many who were astonished at him, so marred was his appearance, beyond human semblance, his form beyond that of mortals, so he shall startle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him, for that which has not been told them they shall see, and that which they had not heard, they shall contemplate." This rejected group, or a nation that's been dragged into exile and shamed and finished and completely ended, an astonishing thing is going to happen. In Romans chapter 15, just a little one there, 15 verse 21, we read, Paul writes, "Thus I make it my ambition to proclaim the good news, not where Christ has been named, so that I don't build on someone else's foundation, but as it is written, those who have never been told of him shall see, those who've never heard of him shall understand." Like playing with it, bringing in the text whenever it kind of, because he's just full of it. It just comes in and he quotes it here in a relation to something quite different. Back in chapter 48, verse 6, prior to what we did earlier, "You have heard, now see all this, and will you not declare it? From this time forward, I make you hear new things, hidden things that you have not known." So that's back in 48. Similar theme here. "That which had not been told them they shall see, that which they hadn't heard they shall contemplate." So people were astonished at how, I'm taking sides here in the argument, but just suggesting, people were astonished at the terrible destruction of Jerusalem and the end of the nation and dragged off into exile. That's the end of it. Well, they're going to be even more astonished by the resurrection of the people, by the return, etc., etc. The text continues now into chapter 53. "Who has believed what we have heard? To whom has the arm of Yahweh been revealed? Pause and read John chapter 12. They did not believe in Jesus. This was to fulfill the word spoken by the prophet Isaiah, quote, "Lord, who has believed our message? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?" So they're quoting this in a totally different context in a way, but you'll see connections. So back to our poem. He grew up before us like a young plant, like a root out of dry ground. Devastated Judah. He has no form or majesty, and we looked at him. Nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. Who wants to look at the Jews in Auschwitz? Who would admire that? Who would want to look at the Jews in exile and think it's something beautiful? No one would. He was despised and rejected by others, a man of suffering, acquainted with infirmity. And as one from whom others hide their faces, he was despised. We held him of no account. So the figure, the metaphor of the poem, the hymn, I'm suggesting, is perhaps the whole people, the exiled people. Perhaps this group that have been pushed out, despised, rejected even from the synagogue, maybe in exile. Romans chapter 10, verse 16 reads, "Not all have obeyed the good news, for Isaiah says, 'Lord, who has believed our message?'" Philippians 2, 7 to 8, "He emptied himself, taking the form of a slave," this is Jesus now, "became obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross." So Jesus was treated like this too. So there's allusions and references back to our song. Chapter 53, verse 4. I've put a heading there, "Suffering can be redemptive." Well, let's read the text. "Surely he has borne our infirmities and carried our diseases. We counted him stricken, struck down by God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions." The whole nation suffered because we sinned. Well, this group was pushed out because of the sin of the people and their refusal to listen to the prophetic word. "He was wounded for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the punishment that made us whole, and by his bruises we are healed." All of us, like sheep, have gone astray. We've turned to our own way, and Yahweh has laid on him the iniquity of us all. And I think you can see what I'm trying to do, of trying to go back and see what might Isaiah have meant, what might the school of Isaiah have meant when they wrote that poem. What were they referring to? And I'm just giving you suggestions which I hope might make sense to you. And because the prophecy is all directed to real people in a real situation. And then it becomes quite a beautiful one. Let's look at some of these texts in the New Testament which clearly allude to it, if not quote it. Jesus healing people. It says, Matthew says, pointing to his brothers and sisters and aunties and uncles, saying, "Go, look at Isaiah. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took our infirmities and bore our diseases." If this group of the Isaiah school were pushed out because they were trying to encourage us and heal us and love us, well, even more so, Jesus. 1 Corinthians 15:3 reads, "Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures." Now, what does "in accordance with the Scriptures" mean? Well, it alludes to this, it alludes to Psalm 22, it alludes to the many, it's not quoting any text here, but it's saying, adding to the fact that Christ died because of our sins, is going back and saying, "Now read your scriptures. It's all over the place. Have a good look again and you'll see that he's consistent with everything we ever knew. You should have expected this." Romans 4:25, "He was handed over to death for our trespasses." Not exactly a quote, but surely you can see the connection. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 21 to 2, quotes a lot of this. I'll just read it to you from the beautiful letter of Peter. Christ suffered for you, he says to the community, leaving you an example so that you should follow in his steps. Quote, he committed no sin, no deceit was found in his mouth. When he was abused, he didn't return abuse. When he suffered, he didn't threaten. But he entrusted himself to the one who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, so that free from sins we might live for righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed. For you'd gone astray like sheep, but now you've returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls. Back to our Isaiah text. And this is surrounded by quotes. Isaiah 53, verse 7 to 9, and I've referred you to John's Gospel, the book of Revelations, Matthew and Hebrews, and then we've got other texts here. So let's read the text itself now. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. We just saw that in 1 Peter. Like a lamb that's led to the slaughter. Like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, he did not open his mouth. This is actually the text, this actual passage, if you read the Acts of the Apostles, was the text being read by the eunuch in the carriage, and Philip, wasn't it, who he called over to explain it to him. So here it is. In other words, it was the New Testament is really keen to, it's obviously crucial, because they're trying to help people see God revealed in a crucified man, Jesus. So it's a big thing. So they're constantly trying to find ways of talking about it. Here's Leviticus talks about the sheep sacrificed as a reparation offering, the asham, Leviticus chapter 5, verse 14 to 19, and that's the reference allusion here, the sheep being there to repair. So our text goes on. By a perversion of justice, he was taken away. Who of his contemporaries gave this any thought? For he was cut off from the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of his people. Once again, we're talking about the whole nation taken into exile because of the sin that's constantly said. Is it the Isaiah school? Could be both. They made his grave with the wicked and his tomb with the rich, though he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. Is it talking about their leader who was actually so maltreated that he died in exile? We just haven't got the evidence, but it's quite not unlikely. Here we have Jeremiah chapter 11, verse 18 to 20. It was Yahweh who made it known to me, and I knew. Jeremiah's writing at the time of the destruction of Jerusalem, which is our period. Then you showed me their evil deeds, but I was like a gentle lamb led to the slaughter. I didn't know it was against me that they devised scheme. To you I have committed my cause. A similar use of poetic imagery from the temple experience of these lambs taken quietly and then slaughtered in the temple. Verse 10 and 11. And I've just alerted you to a difference between the Masoretic text and the Septuagint, that is, the Greek version of the Hebrew Bible. I don't want to make it that significant, but there are differences that you need to just observe. In the Masoretic text, it reads, it was the will of Yahweh to crush him with pain. That's the Hebrew translation. Greek, it was the will of Yahweh to cleanse him from his wound, which is the original, I don't know. They're different, clearly. But the rest of it is the same in both. He has laid down his life as a reparation offering. He will, you see, his offspring. He will prolong his days. Through him the will of Yahweh shall prevail. From his anguish of soul he will see and be content. he will see his offspring, this condemned group, this dreadfully treated community, will return, will rise, will have offspring, will carry on the mission. And if you apply it to Jesus, you can do that for yourself quite easily, I'm sure. Verse 11, by his knowledge my righteous servant shall make righteous. He bears the burden of their iniquities. Righteous means doing the will of God, being wise as to what is right, right wise. Jesus saw his mission, he had to think too. Jesus had to find words to express his experiences of God and his mission and his prayer. Where's he going to find his words? Well, he has to find his words wherever we all find our words, from the tradition, from their religious culture. So this, I'd say, helped Jesus interpret what his mission was. He says here in chapter 10, verse 45 of Mark, the Son of Man came to give his life as a ransom for many. By his knowledge, my righteous servant shall make many righteous. He bears the burden of their iniquities. The Last Supper, Mark chapter 14. This is the blood of the covenant poured out for many. For the multitude, really. Not for an elite, not for a small group, but for many. That doesn't mean not for all, by the way. It's for anyone who wants to take it. But it's many. It reaches beyond the in-group. Here's Romans chapter 5. The free gift is not like the trespass. He's talked about Adam and sin and so on. For if the many died through one man's trespass, referring to the story of Adam, are you okay with that? Much more surely have the grace of God and the free gift in the grace of the one man, Jesus, abounded for the many. Through the obedience of one, many shall be made righteous. I think he's drawing on a similar verse in different ways. Now, if Adam, in the story, Adam's sin affects many, much more so will the beauty of Jesus affect many. Well, of course, Adam's sin affects all, and so does Jesus. But it's big, it's all-encompassing. And the conclusion to this poem, chapter 53, verse 12, here's the end of it. Therefore I will allot him a portion with the great. He shall divide the spoil with the strong. He'll be victorious. Because he poured himself to death and was numbered among the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. And we have these. The God of our ancestors has glorified his servant Jesus. Acts chapter 3. Peter's speech. I will allot him a portion with the great, etc. Here's Luke chapter 22. The scriptures must be fulfilled. He was numbered among the transgressors. This is him dying with the thief on either, or the freedom fighter, or depends on what side you're on, what you call them, on either side being crucified. So he was numbered among the transgressors. There it is. That's a quote. Here's Luke again. Jesus kept on praying, Father, forgive them. Kept on praying. He made intercession for the transgressors. So they're reflecting on the poem. They're looking at Jesus. They're trying to make the links all the time. The connection between acceptance of suffering and exaltation is a connection that is made often in the New Testament when Jesus' disciples speak of Jesus' death and resurrection. And this poem encourages that in them.